You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, May 13th, 2015, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
Have you guys recovered from our 10-hour marathon yet?
Oh, my God. That was a walk in the park. Guys, did that seem like 3 hours to you? It was just like, what? It's over? You're kidding.
It was very fast.
The first 5 hours seemed to be about 1 hour to me. I couldn't believe when I looked back at our countdown clock. 5 hours to go? What? Where? We just got started.
It was weird, right? It kind of snowballed. Like, you know, of course, as we're going into it, we're thinking, oh, man, you know, 10 hours, a lot of content. Yeah, we did 24 hours, but still, we were a lot younger then. And then once we hit the halfway point, all of a sudden, I'm like, whoa, we've got so many interviews left and a ton of news items. And before you know it, like, bingo, the show ended. So we really filled it. I was really surprised we didn't go through anywhere near our news items.
Anywhere near, Jay, I prepared like maybe 15 or 14 different things. I think I used three of them. I got tons of leftover stuff, which was great for this week because I made it a lot easier. But still, it was like, it's because the interviews were so good that we just couldn't stop them. So that just ate up a good chunk of every hour.
Oh, yeah.
I had someone email me saying that my Star Wars science or fiction and one of the items I got wrong, right? So I was doing some research again. I mean, believe me, I searched quite a bit online to not only find those, but to try to vet them out. And unfortunately, like I found there was a lot of like repeat of the same exact information.
That happens.
So there was one of them that I said where Lucas was hiding in Empire Strikes Back. He was hiding what Darth Vader says to Luke when he cuts his hand off. You know, the famous line, Luke, I am your father. And I read on many websites that the fake line that he told the guy that physically played Darth Vader to say is, Luke, you are your own father, right?
Yes.
And I thought that was extraordinarily weird and odd. And then there was a story behind it that he came up with some time travel and everything. Now, the emailer said that that's false. And the actual thing that he said was, Obi-Wan killed your father. And he also said that Mark Hamill, who played Luke Skywalker, was told very, very close to when he had to act that scene. He did know what the line actually was. So, All right. So now this, the emailer said, came from a DVD documentary that he saw out of Mark Hamill's mouth. So I would tend to believe that over the other one that is all over the web, but I'm going to continue to do some research and hopefully I can find a YouTube clip of that or whatever to verify. So that's 90%. I got that one wrong. So I apologize. I don't think any of you guys actually picked that one, so it doesn't really matter.
Damn.
But
didn't affect the outcome. Yeah, but yeah, it's hard. That's one of the, we talked about that before on the internet. You find multiple sources, but they all essentially lead back to the same source. That's why you always have to go back to primary sources.
Yeah.
And that's the primary sources are really the only ones that count, because otherwise this sort of thing happens.
But, yeah. Assuming you can get to a primary source.
Yeah. You can't always get to it, but you should try. That's really one of the tricks of doing good research is knowing, first of all, that you have to do it and knowing how to wind your way back to primary sources. I spend a lot of time sometimes, like I know something, like I know it, you know, I mean, it's something that I've encountered many times before, but I need to find a primary reference which supports it as a fact. And I could spend like half my time writing a blog post just tracking down one reference just to document something which I'm pretty sure is true, but without the reference, I can't say it for sure. You know what I mean? It's tough.
Yeah.
I love, though, the fact that on the show, even like with things like Star Wars, you know, somebody is going to write in and say, hey, that's wrong. And it's interesting when you find an expert, or in this case, you know, this guy's
a nerd.
A bigger nerd than we are, which is awesome, you know, and I bow to him. It's cool. I love it. I think the corrections like that, we do appreciate them, so keep sending them in.
Yeah, especially if they involve Jar Jar Binks, please. Address them to Bob.
All right, Bob, tell us about this week's Forgotten Superhero of Science.
Hey, guys, for this week in Forgotten Superheroes of Science, I'm covering Patrick Matthew, who was the first person to offer the modern conception of natural selection as a mechanism for macroevolution. Ever hear of him? Probably not.
I've heard of Charles Darwin.
I never had. Well, that's just it. Everybody knows Charles Darwin, theory of evolution, right? Everybody. I mean, probably.
And Alfred Russel Wallace. You guys know Alfred Russel Wallace?
Of course, and then 1A and 1B.
I mean, I remember first hearing about Wallace years ago, years after I knew Darwin. But you dig a little deeper, you find Wallace. And he came up independently with a similar idea, but it was many years after Darwin, but before Darwin published anything. But if you dig even deeper, though, you'll find someone called Patrick Matthew. Now, Matthew was a Scottish landowner and fruit farmer who contributed to our understanding of horticulture, silviculture, and agriculture. And he was the first person, the very first person, to make that critical conceptual leap that natural selection, as we define it today, drives the evolution of species into new species. And you could see evidence of this in an obscure appendix to his 1831 book on naval timber and arboriculture. Now, in this book, he describes artificial selection and how he figured out it could be used to greatly improve the quality of timber by eliminating poor quality trees. And this discovery, thinking about it, he realized, and it led him to this revolutionary insight of natural selection years before anybody else that he mentioned in the book very briefly. So this discovery went unnoticed, and there were even a few periodicals who reviewed his book, and apparently they did not recognize the importance of what this guy had said in the book. So keep in mind, though, it's not my intention to diminish Darwin or even Wallace in any way. You know, just having an idea, even an amazingly revolutionary one, is not nearly enough for science. You need to also collect and present evidence about that idea, and that is what Darwin did in spades. Even Darwin's joint paper with Wallace in 1858 announcing the theory didn't even make much of a stir. Did you know that? The paper was just, didn't really do much.
Why was that? How weird.
Because you don't have the evidence that he presented in Origin of Species. That is the book. That is what initiated his revolution, and not the paper that he published with Wallace.
Yeah, the idea itself was not brand new. It wasn't like, whoa, no one ever said that before, because that's been around. The idea of evolution just changed over time. I mean, then lots of the elements of it were there. It was, you're right, Bob, Origin of Species, one long argument, laying it out, and like, here it is. This is what actually happened, and here's the evidence for it.
Exactly. So he deserves all the respect that he's gotten for this. In my opinion, well above Wallace as well.
Absolutely.
But Matthew still was the very first to anticipate the true mechanism of evolution, and he stands with Darwin and Wallace as the only three who have to have independently come up with the idea. So he should be known for that. So remember Patrick Matthew. Mention him to your friends, perhaps when discussing heritable phenotypic traits or negative selection on rare alleles.
How rare?
I do want to read a quote from that book, Bob, where he basically lays it out.
Yes. I meant to do that, actually. Go ahead.
There is more beauty and unity of design in this continual balancing of life to circumstance and greater conformity to those dispositions of nature which are manifest to us than in total destruction and new creation. It is improbable that much of this diversification is owing to commixture of species nearly allied. All change by this appears very limited and confined within the bounds of what we call species. The progeny of the same parents under great differences of circumstances might, in several generations, even become distinct species incapable of co-reproduction.
Now, say it backwards.
Yeah, but Matthews never abandoned his notion that of natural theology, that there was a creation, never really fully brought it into like a theory of evolution. He just realized that selection could actually change species over time and even change one species into another. So he just had that one piece of it, but not the whole thing.
And natural selection was actually talked about at that time, but not natural selection as we define it today. It was a different conception of natural selection. So that's important too, because people did talk about it before him, but he's the one that nailed it. He made that insight.
All right, we've got an update this week. You guys remember the Orbo technology?
Oh, God, yes.
Oh, yeah, that Irish company?
Yes.
Stern?
Yes.
Stern. The Irish company Stern several years ago claimed that they had a perpetual energy device, and they had a big public demonstration where they were going to run devices off of it and show that it was producing energy without any inputs. And, of course, it didn't work. It's a total flop, a complete embarrassment. And we knew at the time, you know, that the company didn't vanish. They said, oh, we just have to tweak it. You know, a couple screws loose. We'll get it back. You know, no problem. They always say that, right? That whenever the big demonstration fails, it isn't a fundamental flaw in their concept. It was just a screw loose. You know what I mean? Just got to tighten a few bolts here and there and we'll get it to work, you know?
Yep.
So they've been quietly working apparently on their technology over the last few years. Of course, cynics think that this is all just an elaborate scheme to keep investors on the hook.
Yes, yes.
You know?
That's never happened before in history.
Right. That they've apparently have it now the Orbo Cube, which is a cube. Looks very much like an Apple type of device, you know, which is a nice clean metallic cube, you know, with one little USB port in it. And they claim that this is a never die battery, an Orbo powered never die battery.
What is that supposed to mean?
That it's a perpetual battery. You could charge your phone off of it forever. You know, it just always produces energy. Right? So it's a free.
It doesn't heat up. It doesn't.
Yeah, it's a free energy thing. It's not like a conventional battery. So first word came out that they were doing a public demonstration of the Orbo Cube in a pub. Slattery's Pub. Yeah, they're Irish. I guess that makes sense. But, you know, there's the box and a little nest, you know, behind the bar and people going up there and charging their phones off of it. Of course, given the size of the box and the fact that they didn't let anybody peek inside of it, it's not a demonstration of anything. There could easily be some actual batteries in there. You know what I mean? It's like, it's not a demonstration of anything. They were supposed to leave it there for a long time to show that it's continuously producing power and it's not plugged into anything. And of course, the skeptics were speculating, okay, so what are they going to do? They say, oh, we got to take it into the back room to tweak it or whatever. You know, where's the con? What are they going to do to swap out the batteries or to recharge the batteries or whatever. So after a couple of days, they cut short the demonstration because they were getting too much publicity.
Oh, yeah. Too much publicity is
in
a
pub,
bad thing
in a pub
when you're trying to
exactly.
do this. Yes.
So now they're saying that this was never intended to be a public demonstration.
Nah.
It was intended to be a field trial.
Yeah. No. So why would they have to bring it to a pub instead of just doing it in their laboratory? What's the difference? It's a battery.
I guess because the field trial has got to be out in the world, you know, out of the lab, whatever. And then the owner of the pub announced it on their Facebook page by mistake. You know, they weren't supposed to do that. And so when it became apparent that the world was paying attention, they sort of called it off. There you go. They showed us a battery that could charge stuff for a couple of charges. You know, basically, if there were a lithium ion battery in there, it performed exactly like you would expect.
So what do you think, Steve? Is it a scam?
Well, I mean, we know it's a scam, you know, a scam in that they don't have a perpetual motion machine because it's impossible. You're right. I mean, this is
only by the laws of physics.
Yeah. I mean, Occam's razor dictates that they're behaving in a fraudulent manner.
Yeah.
Yes.
That
not exactly transparent.
It's probably not that they're just accidentally behaving that way because of miscommunications and errors and a series of unfortunate events, right? And that they actually have physics altering, world changing technology. The far simpler explanation is one of two things, right? In these types of situations, either they know exactly what they're doing and they're just stringing along investors, or they're true believers who are so caught up in their own belief that they're just special pleading their way into a corner. You know what I mean? That they're just
fool or fraud.
Yeah, they're just calming. Yeah, so they may be deceiving themselves, but either way, there's some deception going on. But obviously, we don't know. We can't read their mind. We don't know if they're sincere and mistaken, or if they know what they're doing. But either way, the behavior always turns out to be the same, right? So I say doesn't matter, because in the end, the behavior is identical. It's always these exact type of shenanigans, where we never get an actual good test, or it fails and you get excuses.
Yeah.
You know, and who are they trying to convince with those excuses? Doesn't matter. They're lame. They're always lame. And Occam's answer is always the same.
They're what, 5 or 6 years into this, and they've got
more, like 10 years now. Yeah.
Oh, 10 years? Yeah. And they've shown absolutely zero.
A pub demo.
in that, and not even, you know, an yeah. interrupted one, and who knows really what the hell was going on.
How funny would it have been if somebody just ran in that bar, stole it, and then took it apart and just let everyone know, this is what's in that mother.
Well, and Bob, it's just a battery. That's all it is. It's just some kind of battery that they claimed was good.
Right, but I want to see pictures of it. You know, imagine you see off the shelf Duracell batteries inside that. That's what I want to see.
Yeah, that would have been funny.
Yeah, it's located in between some bottles of Jameson over there. You would have had to been in cahoots with the bartender. Hey, go grab me a bottle of Jameson. And, you know, he grabs it, reaches for the wrong thing, kind of slips it off to you, and then you go running out into the night.
Right.
So you can bust the thing open. That would have been hilarious. And I think Perry definitely would have done something like that.
Yeah.
Or wanted to.
Well, you got to go in there with a camera. You got to go up to it and open it right there. I mean, you can't take it away because then they'll claim you swapped it out or something.
Of course.
It's got to be totally transparent, which, of course, is never what we get from them, right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, Jay, you're going to tell us about another sort of energy thing that's a little dubious. That's also a follow-up to a prior news item. But we've been getting some emails about this, so get us up to speed.
Yeah, if you guys remember the solar roadway, right?
Yes. Solar freaking roadways.
Yeah, freaking.
That's right. All over the freaking country.
Yeah, that was a news item last year. And there's a company called Solar Road, S-O-L-A Road. And they started a test of this solar bike path November of 2014. So the bike path had, you know, solar cells lining the surface that had like a glass and then some type of laminate protective coating on it. And the company decided to do a six-month test. So that six-month test just ended, and the company revealed its results in this press release that came out on May 7th. So first off, they just claimed, of course, that it was a success, and they're boasting that it was beyond their expectations. Sten DeWitt, who is a spokesman for Solar Road, said in the press release, "The bike road opened half a year ago and already generated over 3,000 kilowatt hours. This can provide a single-person house with electricity for a year or power an electric scooter to drive 2.5 times around the world. If we translate this into annual yield, we expect more than 70 kilowatt hours per square meter per year, which we predicted as an upper limit to the laboratory stage. We can therefore conclude that it was a successful first half a year." And he also stated, "We did not expect a yield as high as this so quickly." So try to remember that statement right there. Okay. Now, if you continue reading the press release, they mentioned that the solar pathway, again, it delaminated on one of the sections due to temperature fluctuations, and they're already working to fix the issue, and I'm sure that they are. Many news outlets, you know, reported about this news item, you know, great success, everything. But the problem is that when you do a deeper critical analysis of the data, it really shows that it's not that good. It's really not so great. There's a YouTube blogger on this YouTube blog called EEV Blog. And he did a deep dive on it.
He killed it.
He did a deep dive on it with a critical analysis, and he went over their six-month test results. And check this out. The formal results stated that it produced 3,000 kilowatt hours over the 6 months using a 122.5 square meter connected solar panel array that was, you know, put on top of a concrete slab, covered with glass, and then covered with some type of laminate. So to break down the math, the company predicted that they would get 24.5 kilowatt hours per square meter. And the solar array actually averaged out to, take a guess, guys, what do you think the figure would be after the hype from their press release? They initially said 24.5 kilowatt hours per square meter. What's your guess?
24.6?
A trillion.
No. No, it actually generated 25 kilowatt hours per square meter. Now, This is mathematically more than what they expected, but it's only slightly a tiny bit more. And it's not enough to make the big deal about it that they did. I mean, think about it. 24.5 to 25 is not that big a deal. You know, and the internet took this release and the fact that the company said they did not expect the yield as high as this so quickly, and it, you know, greatly beyond their expectations and all that. You know, there was a ton of hype in that press release, but the blogger who did the deep dive analysis found that it really was just a marginal increase, and it is pretty much what they predicted. It didn't do anything. There was nothing exceptional about this test whatsoever.
It's you're right. It's not probably not even significant, just within with their ability to measure.
No, it's not. It's actually exactly what we would expect if you're looking at comparative data. And that's exactly what this blogger did on YouTube. And it was very fun to watch him just simplify the math and show you exactly what's going on. So what he did was he found three other solar arrays that were very close to the actual bike path test.
Just a few kilometers away, which was a wonderful idea.
Yeah, it was brilliant. And it was really cool that he could find them and then also gain access to the data. So what he ended up doing was he just compared the same exact 6 months between the bike path and a few other solar roof-mounted arrays. And what he showed the graphs side by side. And what was cool about it is he showed they had the same peaks and valleys to show that they were experiencing the same amount of solar radiation, right? Like the same amount of light was hitting them. Or the same amount of sunlight was being emitted around them, right? Now, what his side-by-side comparison did was it showed that the rooftop solar panels collected nearly double the amount of energy. And then he quantified it and very simply explained why they collected double. And there's a few good reasons behind it. One of them is that rooftop arrays are angled. Now, I'm not saying that these are the ones that do tracking. The ones that track actually do very well. They're like as efficient as you can get as far as, from angle to sunlight, they do the best. But just ones that are angled towards the sun appropriately will capture approximately 20% more light than the bike path ones, which were just,
flat
facing straight up. That's number one. Also, another problem was that the protective glass also filters out a percentage of the light. It's just some more material for the sunlight to pass through and more things for it to bounce around on and off of. And that loses another 10 to 15%. And then the bike path array also heats up because it's sandwiched in the concrete and the glass and the plastic laminate. And that also lowers the efficiency, right? Because heat lowers electrical efficiency overall. So he said, when you add up the 20%, and the 10 to 15% and then the percentage of energy loss due to heat there. And there you go. You can get to that 50% number to explain why it's collecting what it is, what the bike pathway is collecting. So at this point in time, unfortunately, because we don't have super, super efficient solar arrays and we can't put in something that's going to start off by collecting 80%, we're in the 12 to 15 to maybe 17% range with the most efficient. And I think things that go into outer space can get even a higher percentage than that. But the ones that are terrestrial are definitely still not getting the percentage high enough to make building these arrays, roadways and bike paths and things that are going to get partially covered by trees and be, in the shade by cars or people going by. And the fact that they're not angled and that they're sandwiched, all of these things add up to the fact that this is not the best way to do it. The best way to do it is for people to put them on their roofs. And that's what they recommend.
Yeah. So basically he said it's half as efficient and 2 to 4 times as expensive. At least, we would need longer term studies to really know what their maintenance is going to be, but even assuming no extraordinary maintenance, which is not a good assumption, they're two to four times more expensive. So it's a dumb idea, is the bottom line. Yeah.
But wait, now
and part of the path broke. Actually, they showed pictures of where it cracked.
One panel broke. Yeah.
But guys, I'm all for companies that are spending money to develop technology, do research. The only thing about this I don't like is that they came out with that slightly deceptive press release.
The hype.
Okay. And of course you expect a company to do that, but still, it was so obviously easy to disprove via having a little bit of smarts and doing some math, and there you go. You just figured out. Hey,
yeah, they're not being honest and transparent. If they're really being honest, they would just come right out and say this is 50% of the efficiency of a rooftop solar panel with this projected cost. And therefore it makes sense or doesn't make sense in this type of application or whatever. But they're not. They're just glossing over that and hyping it and everything. Yeah. So they're just being very deceptive, in my opinion. The video blogger also made the comment.
South Korea?
Yeah, South Korea.
That was awesome.
They have showed a highway where they had raised solar panels on the midsection, which they made into a bike path. So there was a bike path between the two lanes.
What an awesome idea.
Yeah, covered with solar panels. He's like, there you go. That's if you want to put solar panels on a roadway, that's how you do it. You raise them up over the median. You don't put them on the surface that the cars are driving on.
So how do you exit out of that, I wonder? Because you're in the middle of a highway on a bike path, and that's really cool. And the fact that they added solar is even, you know, even cooler. But think about it. You're in the middle of a highway. I wonder how you get out. You got to cross the highway? Or do they have like an
elevator? Maybe they have tunnels.
Carefully.
Yeah, they must. But it was a very cool idea.
They have entry and exit points.
Now that's a solar freaking highway. That is.
If we're going to do that. But I mean, for right now, I agree that rooftops are the resource that we want to use. I mean, that's the low-hanging fruit.
It's inevitable. We got to saturate that market. And it will. I'm confident that we will. It's going to reach a point where it's going to be a no-brainer.
All right, Evan, we're going to shift gears quite a bit here. You're going to tell us about an interesting delusion.
A delusion that I had never heard of before.
This is cool.
So this actually took me aback. The BBC's online magazine had an article this past week entitled "The People Who Think They Are Made of Glass." And my first thought was, wow, these people must be delusional. And then I read the article and I realized, wow, these people are actually delusional because there's an actual documented psychiatric disorder in which people believe that they have body parts that are made of glass or some sort of brittle material that will shatter, crack, splinter, shard, smash, or what
have you. That's so odd.
Plus, it's called the glass delusion. That's the name of it.
The glass menagerie.
It's a giveaway. It's foreshadowing. This specific delusion was well documented as early as the 15th century, and there were many documented cases that lasted well into the 19th century. The article described, in fact, this famous case, the late medieval French King Charles VI, and he ruled from the late 14th and early 15th centuries. He was one of the most notable sufferers of glass delusion. He was reported to have wrapped himself in blankets to prevent his buttocks from breaking. Now, I'm not sure if His Highness ever looked in the mirror at his hindquarters at some point in his life, but he was born with a crack in his buttocks, so I don't know if that had anything to do with it.
Yeah, now he actually thought that his butt was made of glass. Would that consider him a glass hole?
Oh, man.
Perhaps, although the French equivalent, and I doubt anybody would say that to his face, or posterior for that matter. Now, the disorder seemed to have faded in the 19th century, or at least kind of morphed into something else more contemporary for the times. In those centuries, glass was not as common as we realize it is, you know, today. It wasn't used everywhere. And it lost some of its wonder. It was, you know, by the time the 19th century came around, glass was pretty much everywhere and it lost its luster. But fellow Andy Lemaine, I'll pronounce it. I'll say the J is silent. Who's a psychiatrist from Leiden in the Netherlands. He uncovered a contemporary case. A young man turned up at the university clinic in Leiden, and he was claiming to be made of glass. The psychiatrist talked to him for several hours, and he confirmed that, yes, this person really does believe that he's made of glass.
Mm-hmm.
He says that based on his interview, the patient had recently had an accident. And from that, Lamdin began to formulate a theory as to why a modern person might still have a glass delusion, something, you know, from way back when. His conclusion was that the person in question, or the patient, was using the glass delusion as sort of a distance regulator. So following the accident, he and his family became overprotective, and the glass delusion was an attempt to regain privacy and hide from an overbearing family. But that's just one of several theories as to what the glass delusion is really all about. Other professionals think it's a manifestation of anxiety concerning fragility, or perhaps a response to the feeling of the world closing in around you, a threat to one's personal space, in other words. Other professionals have written that it could be an exaggerated fear of public humiliation, such as falling and tripping in front of other people. There's no standard, I suppose. There's no one opinion as to exactly what this is or was or continues to be. But it is a fascinating theory. You know, in the 19th century, there were reported cement delusions, because cement was emerging as kind of a new super building material at the time. And, people had, you know, sort of these, cement delusion beliefs that, you know, they were made of cement or part of their body was partially cement or something along
those
lines.
So, I mean, what's probably going on is that the glass delusion is not a specific entity. It's not like its own mental illness. It's just a more generic delusion of a certain type, like what we would call a somatic delusion, a delusion about one's body, that manifests in a way that is based upon the culture.
Culture, yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So it's the delusion itself is not specific, but the cultural manifestation is. Like in the U.S., people who have paranoid delusions think that the CIA is monitoring them. They don't have a CIA delusion. You know what I mean? They just have a paranoid mm-hmm. delusion, which is manifesting in a manner consistent with their culture. So some people have speculated that because a king had this delusion, it became widely known. And so other people.
Legitimized in a way.
Well, it's other people with this type of delusion latched onto that detail because it's something that was in the culture. And then once it culturally faded, people with delusions latched onto other things, you know, other metaphors or whatever as a focus of their delusion.
And Steve, it reminds me of hypnagogic and hypnopompic hallucinations, yeah. where it's a similar thing that centuries ago, it wasn't an alien taking you out of your bed. It was, a succubi or a witch sucking the life out of you. And that was a normal kind of, well, I guess a little bit of an abnormal kind of biological event of where you're waking up, you're having a waking dream, and your mind latches onto the culture to explain it. And this is kind of not a perfect analogy, but it's similar.
And it's possible that he was just schizophrenic, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That was just delusional because he had schizophrenia. All right. You guys want to hear some other interesting somatic delusions?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. There's some good ones.
Alice in Wonderland syndrome. Which is where you think you're very tiny.
Micropsia. Oh, wow.
Or that other things are really tiny. Yeah.
So some objects in the mirror are larger than they appear. Yeah. So.
People actually have their perception change where they do feel that small?
Yeah, absolutely. But what's interesting is that may not be the same type of delusion. That may actually be a neurological syndrome, like where just a part of the brain that it tells you how big you are in relation to other things. It's like an alteration of perception. It could be a perception of time, space, size, and it can be induced by drugs, you know, which is a good sign that it's probably an actual neurological syndrome rather than just something that a generic delusion is latching onto. Bob, you'd like this one, Bob. Cotard's syndrome.
Oh, I like that one. Yeah.
The walking corpse syndrome.
Oh, yes. That was actually just on an episode of Hannibal. They think they are dead. So that's a real, real thing. Yes. That's awesome.
That's crazy.
Which is very debilitating.
I don't know if that's awesome.
We don't use the C word, Jay.
Fascinating.
Don't use the C word.
All right, what can
you say? You just say that's interesting. You could use that's debilitated because they don't take care of themselves. You know?
Yeah.
So, Steve, can you, through therapy and drugs, like, fix things like that? Like,
yeah, depending on what the underlying cause is.
I feel really sorry for those people. God, could you imagine? Life is hard enough as it is. I can't imagine me walking around going, I'm actually a corpse. Yeah. I'm actually 3 inches tall. Like, what the hell?
All right, here's some other cool ones. So, Capgras syndrome is neurological. This one's definitely a focal neurological damage to the brain causes this, where you think that people close to you have been substituted with imposters because it's a disconnect between your recognition of the person and the emotional attachment to them.
I thought that was called the pod syndrome. Joke.
Oh, I was saying, joke. Yeah, gotcha. I got the reference.
Now I guess.
Right. So your visual system actually, you know, connects to your limbic system, your emotional system. So when you see somebody that is alive and that you have emotions for, you feel the appropriate emotions just based on the image. But if that connection is damaged, you don't feel the emotion. And that makes people feel like, well, I don't feel about that person what I should. They must be an imposter.
Think about that. That would be terrifying.
Yeah.
Jay, I'm thinking of having you walk in the room and just seeing Jay, but not, you know, having
feeling in your gut. It's not
terrible.
Jay.
That would be terrible.
In fact, there are documented cases where that has led to the murder.
People attacking
murder each other. Of the loved one. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Othello syndrome is...
Oh, it's a good game.
Is an obsession that your significant other is cheating on you.
Oh.
Like a completely ridiculous obsession. You know, not just a word.
Yeah, yeah. It's got to be.
Ekbom's syndrome, also called delusional parasitosis. So these are people who have a delusion that they are infested with parasites.
Ouch.
Oh, my God.
Not good. But we are really infested, if you think about it.
Yeah. If you count mites and things like that. But I mean, they think like this is probably the cause of many people who think that they have Morgellons.
Morgellons, yeah. I was going to say, yeah. Little things growing or coming out of their body. And
then here's one last one, the doppelganger syndrome, where people are convinced that they have a doppelganger out there who's trying to steal their life.
Like trying to mess up their lives and, oh boy.
So it,
what a torture that must be for these people.
I can't help but think, guys, you know, we're talking about the glass delusion. You know, what kind of, you know, culturally dependent delusions are we going to have in the future? Are we going to have a nano delusion? Like, I'm going to fall apart into all these little tiny particles. Or how about an AI delusion where you think that you're actually a construct? Somebody built you and you're not really a human.
I have the skeptics illusion where I think everybody's a scam artist.
Yeah.
Hey, well, I have a pretty cool thing I found recently. So I heard that there is a 4 terabyte SSD drive now available, right?
Wow.
So the largest one previously was 1 terabyte. You can get that for about $380 now on Amazon. Guess what the 4 terabyte cost?
$2,000.
$29,000.
Oh, my God.
They out of their minds?
Just came out.
$29,000.
Yep, let's see how long it takes for it to come down. Well.
Yeah, it's a big market for that, right?
So you guys remember the shrinking penis delusion?
That's not a delusion.
That's another culturally, it's a culturally dependent delusion. Yeah.
Right.
So it shows that culture does play a role in these specific details of how. You know, those kind of things manifest. But it is obviously, I'm fascinated with all the various ways in which our minds and our brains fail and create things like this. And Bob, you're going to tell us about another one. This is not a delusion, but an illusion, one that could be generated in a lab.
Yeah, this is fascinating. Neuroscientists from Sweden's Karolinska Institute have created a perceptual illusion of invisibility that actually had physiological effects on the people that they were testing. But what's really cool is that the effects it actually had on the body. Now, it just really got me thinking about invisibility, and it made me realize that just how, you know, incredible the idea of invisibility is, so much so that, I mean, can you guys imagine all the movies and books and how much there are in fiction? I mean, I just came up with a list of movies that have an invisible person in it. You got
The Invisible Man?
Abbott and Costello.
The Invisible Woman Returns?
I'm going to lead with Abbott and Costello Meet the Invisible Man. And then Hollow Man, which is a TV show that I remember. And then Invisible.
Oh, yeah. Kevin Bacon plays an invisible rapist. That's great.
Invisible Agent, which I hadn't heard of. And then, of course, you've got the Invisible Man, The Invisible Man Returns, The Invisible Man's Revenge, and then The Invisible Woman. The Invisible Mouse, that was a good one. And my favorite, The Night of the Living Duck. Apparently, there's some invisibility in there. And as a matter of fact, just yesterday, I saw a Fringe episode called Wallflower that had an invisible guy on it. So, and there's just so many more.
To mention Harry Potter and the invisibility cloak.
Harry Potter.
That's true.
Invisible.
If you think about it, though, for the first time, something like an invisibility cloak is really for the first time. It really seems something that could happen, you know, when you start considering what metamaterials have been doing in the past decade.
Bob, don't forget Miss Appear from SpongeBob.
Miss Appear. So what these scientists wanted to do is they wanted to determine how would this affect the brain. If your perception of your body was that it was invisible. So to answer this, you have to look into the most recent publication in the journal Scientific Reports. And what they did was they gave a subject a virtual reality head-mounted display, and they were looking down. And the display was connected to another camera just a few feet away that was pointing down as well, but it was pointing down into nothingness. So there was just empty space there. So when this person looked down, they saw nothing. So when you should be looking at your chest and your abdomen, you're actually seeing nothing. And that's pretty much the crux of what they did to make these people seemed like they were invisible. So they had to test it, though. You know, did they, you know, did they really think that they're invisible or not? So what they had to do was they did two things. The tester was in the between the camera and the person, and he took a paintbrush and he just gently poked the person in the stomach, and he poked the empty space in the stomach. So what the person sees then through his virtual reality helmet was a paintbrush that was poking nothingness, just the middle of the air, but he also felt the poke from the other paintbrush. And that is what they think really did it. Your mind kind of adapted to that visual and tactile experience and made these people kind of, you know, they knew it wasn't real, but it made your mind think that they were invisible.
That's why it's an illusion and not a delusion.
Right, exactly. And to me, this is just that in and of itself was fascinating because you grow up for decades in your body. Your mind is firmly ensconced inside your body. And then just after under a minute of just this one little test, and your mind is like, oh, okay, we're invisible now. And that's pretty much what they showed happened. And to really test it though, what they did was they made a stabbing motion towards the empty space. I think they actually had a knife or something, but they did a stabbing motion and they measured the sweat response and the heart rate of the person. And it was indicative of like fear. I mean, they were really afraid. And in other situations when they were doing that stabbing motion, it didn't happen. So that really, I think it was one of the key bits of evidence that clued them in that, yeah, these people, the mind at least is actually thinking that they are in that empty space.
Yeah. So, I think that's a better description than thinking they're invisible.
Yes,
they've essentially, so this is an extension of a line of experiments that we've talked about before where,
yes, arms and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Trick the brain, because the brain actively creates the sense that you're in your body because you see and feel your body and it all matches. And when you screw with the sensory input by using like virtual reality goggles so that people are seeing like an avatar of themselves. And if they feel what they see happening to the avatar, that's enough in the majority of cases to trick the brain to say, oh, I'm physically in that avatar. So all they did was do that experiment, but see if the person's brain would, transfer their sense of where they are to empty space. So essentially the person is, you know, they're mentally occupying empty space rather than an avatar or a dummy arm or whatever the other variations on this experiment are. Yeah. That's cool. You don't even need a thing. It's just the space itself can be occupied. It's cool.
So, yeah. Steve, why does our brain allow us to do this?
Well, the question is, but, you know, there's a lot of assumptions in that question. The question is that, you know, why wouldn't it, right? So, in other words, there's an assumption there that you would have the sensation of being in your body without the brain having a specific circuit that creates that sensation. But it wouldn't. There are circuits in your brain that create all of your sensations, even the ones you take for granted, like that you control your body, that you're in your body, that your body is separate from the rest of the universe, that it exists as in the time and space, that it's a certain size. You know, all those things are just actively being generated by circuitry in your brain, and we could mess with all of them. You know, that's the bottom line.
Another interesting thing that they did was another test was one for social anxiety with a crowd of strangers. So here I'll give you a quote from the lead author, Arvid Gudestam. He said that we found that their heart rate and self-reported stress level during the performance was lower when they immediately prior had experienced the invisible body illusion compared to when they experienced having a physical body. These results are interesting because they show that the perceived physical quality of the body can change the way our brain processes social cues. So it could actually be used to help people in stressful and social situations. So, and now in the future, they're gonna look at things like, does this affect moral decision making? You know, you've got the typical, anonymous internet assholes that really do things that they really wouldn't do if they were not anonymous. So would, you know, the fact that you believe you're invisible, would that affect moral decision making?
All right. Yeah, it's all very interesting. All right. I want to do just one quick item. I saw this news item where Wyoming passed a law to criminalize citizen science.
Oh my God. Yeah.
That's interesting. What's, is that really what they did? The blog post is by a law student, and Justin Pidot, P-I-D-O-T, and he said that, yep, Wyoming passed this law, which basically says if you go onto any open land, right, so anything outside of like a city or a town, and you collect data, collecting data was interpreted in the broadest sense, so it could be taking pictures. And that with the intent of giving that data to any federal or state agency, that's a criminal act. And that you could be fined up to $5,000 and 6 months in jail for the first offense and 1 year in jail for the second offense.
And why is
Yeah, so it's like, okay, we need some context here because that makes no sense. So I did some more poking around. I found the actual law and yeah, that's what it says, but it's framed as a trespassing law, that what they're really legalizing is trespassing in order to collect this data. And it says that you need to get essentially written permission from the owner of the land.
Okay.
And, all okay. Right. Which, you know, it's superficially is like, okay, but that seems reasonable. You need to get written permission.
But why? But
context. So first of all, why would they care specifically about trespassing to collect data?
Yeah.
Why specifically that? You know, so this can't be just about trespassing, because then they would just make sure that there were adequate laws dealing with trespassing. So I found another analysis where they said, aha, see, the thing is, imagine that a farmer is, or a rancher is, allowing his cattle to drink out of a certain river, and they're, you know, defecating and peeing in the river and contaminating it. Is that farmer going to give permission to some activist to come onto their land and measure bacterial levels in the water? That's what it's meant to prevent. It's meant to prevent citizen scientists documenting bacterial contamination in the environment, like in streams and ponds, et cetera. And this would effectively do that, because if you do this and you know, if you even just pass through their land, that's the other thing. If you just pass, you just walk through their land on your way to collecting data, this law applies to you. So anyway, they're just creating a legal, ability to inhibit people from collecting data on public or private land. And it seems, you know, what these legal bloggers are writing, that the whole point of this is to hide the fact that, these lands may be contaminated with bacteria, you know, beyond levels that are allowed by law.
Okay, so aren't there agencies that are supposed to be going out there and doing the testing to see if there are these violations?
Exactly,
of the
but
law?
The hope they empowered private citizens to do it because they just don't have the resources. So they did. So now they're trying to keep the private citizens who have been empowered by, let's say, like the FDA, from doing this by passing this stupid trespassing law. So
I
it
see.
Does.
So the lobbyists have won this round.
I guess so. I mean, it seems to me that from reading the law itself and from reading multiple analyses of it, that yeah, that's what's happening. They're trying to hide the fact that they're violating the Federal Clean Water Act by making it hard for people to collect data, you know, and give, and specifically to give it to the government. I mean, you know, it's ridiculous.
I wonder if this will hold up.
It's being challenged.
Tested in the courts.
Probably not. It's already being challenged in the courts, and it, probably.
I'd be surprised if it
probably
if it
won't. But how scummy is that, though?
Right. Totally.
Yeah, that is.
It's just so. I mean,
literally and figuratively.
Yeah, it just really. But good on the bloggers for exposing it, because that's just.
Yeah.
That's the power. That's the good power of the internet. You know, something like that, which would 20 years ago would be total obscure local politics. You know, we would get away with all kinds of crap like that. But now, you know, the world could find out and we could mock them openly.
Yep.
Yay.
All right, Jay.
Yes.
It's time to get back into the swing of Who's That Noisy?
I got something. Bob, I think you're really going to like this one.
Ooh.
Listener named Levi Tooker sent this in. And the creep factor on this is pretty high. Check this out. It's pretty cool, right? Was that weird? That was a really good one. So this will be the first time that I'm asking people, write in an email and give me your guess, and whoever guesses first and correctly, I will announce it on the show.
What's the email, Jay?
WTN at theskepticsguy.org.
Thank you.
Okay. That was cool, Jay. I like that one.
Weird.
Let's do a few emails, or as many as we get through. The first one, we actually had a number. I'm not going to read a specific one, but we had about four or five different emails about our black box technology discussion from the 10-hour show, which made it into the podcast version last week, where essentially we were saying that there is this trend as technology matures, essentially, that the ability of the end user to tinker and interface with the technology gets less and less because the technology becomes more and more like a black box. And we used cars and computers as our primary examples. Number of people wrote in to say, hey, I tinker with my cars all the time, or I tinker with my computers all the time. And it's, you know, I disagree with you guys. You guys got this one wrong. But my response was essentially this, that first of all, if I recall, we specifically said, of course, there are still people who tinker with cars and computers. The point is that it's fewer and fewer people. It's getting more and more rarefied. And like one person actually said, I'm an IT professional. So yeah, of course you're an IT. That's why you still tinker with your computers. And also the other point that I think that, you know, maybe we didn't make it clear, and I wanted to clarify this, like people saying, yeah, you could buy a $50 device that will enable you to jack into your onboard computer and interrogate it and find out what the check engine light really means, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you could tune your engine functioning, and you could do stuff. It's like, I get that. But think about it. I think with computers and as cars get more complicated, what's happening is that you're actually tinkering with black boxes, right? You're just rearranging black boxes.
Hmm.
So like when you go into your computer, like I might replace the graphics card, but the graphics card is a black box. You know, I can't build my own graphics card or really even troubleshoot it. I may figure out that that's the problem and know that I need to replace it, but I can't build it itself. Whereas 50 years ago, you could literally build a radio from scratch where you were building it out of every piece, you know, you knew how to make and what it did, or maybe you had some very simple pieces like a vacuum tube or something, but you could, you know, build it pretty close to out of scratch, but you can't build your own circuit board, you know? So the point was that there's this trend, not that nobody's tinkering. I'll also give you an example with software in that like 20, 30 years ago, if I was using a database, I was pretty much talking to that database in the programming language, you know? I was doing it more from the back end. Now I'm interacting with a user interface, you know, an interface that was created for me at the front end. And the back end is more of a black box than it was 20 years ago.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Obviously there are computer programmers who know the back end, but the whole point is as the end user, I'm getting farther and farther away from interacting with the real technology, and I'm more interacting with these black boxes that were created for my user interface. Now, one person did make a very interesting point. I don't know if you guys read this email, but they said that actually people may start tinkering more with their technology because of the internet and access to information, that you know, you could go online and read about how to fix your heater. And so you don't have to get somebody to come into your house and fix it. You could just read online, watch a YouTube video that'll show you how to fix it, and you could do it yourself. And I agree that that is absolutely true, but I think that's a completely separate trend. That's just more information. That's not a statement about the technology itself. And it is interesting, though, to think about where we will end up. You know, we might end up where we are printing our own pieces and assembling our own technology. But again, I think that we're going to be handling black boxes, you know, like components that themselves that we don't understand. And it'll be like, I used myself as a physician as an example. It's like I'm ordering MRIs and prescribing medications and whatnot. I'm interacting with a lot of pieces, but like I can't manufacture the drug. Or if I weren't immersed in modern technology, 99% of my medical knowledge and skills would be completely useless. I still think that trend is correct in terms of that there's a tendency in that direction as technology matures.
Yeah, it reminds me of that saying, Bob, who said this? Arthur C. Clarke, that the more advanced the technology is, the more you can't differentiate it from magic.
It's essentially, yeah.
Yeah, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
Right. I understand the sentiment of a lot of people that wrote in saying, you know, we are still tinkering and we need to tinker. I think that's where it was coming from more, is that they believe, and I believe too, that we need to tinker. But, you know, our technology is at the point now where even at its seemingly most basic forms, like a video card for your computer or, you know, some type of thing for your car, that in and of itself is so complicated that, you know, you'd have to get into taking that apart and figuring out the components and how they work inside of that before you really know what's going on anymore.
All right, let's do one more. This email comes from Ben Allison, who says he's a musician from New York City. New York City? And Ben says, for many years, I've been hearing the refrain that buying local produce is both environmentally and morally better than buying non-local produce. The argument seems to be that shipping produce from far away is wasteful and not environmentally sound. Also, I sometimes sense a subtext to these arguments that support the narrative that buying locally also supports small farms, which I guess are somehow better than large farms or ones that feel corporate. There are a lot of issues here to unpack, and any discussions involving something as basic as food while talking about business are sure to be complicated. But my question is, what does the science say about local versus non-local or distributed farming? Yeah, that's a really good question. I love these kinds of questions because it is a very complicated political issue. You hear lots of claims about it, but there is got to be a science there to unpack. And I tried my best to do that. There's definitely a lot being written about this. First of all, it is absolutely true that our food travels on average quite a distance from farm to fork. You guys have a guess about what the average distance food travels to get to your table?
6,000 miles.
10,000 furlongs.
1,500 miles.
Okay.
Yeah, that's about 2,400 kilometers. Yeah, that's far. That's like halfway across the U.S. on average. The question is how it costs money and it costs carbon, right? Carbon gets released for every mile food has to travel in order for you to eat it. So based upon that logic alone, it is environmentally conscious to try to buy locally so that food has to travel not as far so that you're lowering your carbon footprint. However, like all things, it's more complicated than that. And you have to consider a lot of variables before you could know the true impact of buying locally. First of all, the transportation of food only contributes 10% to the overall carbon footprint of agriculture, of making food, right? Growing food. Of course, different types of food has a different carbon footprint. Beef and sheep, goats, are the highest. And then, you know, different kinds of vegetables are much less. Chicken's actually not that bad. Fish isn't bad, and vegetables. Lentils, for some reason, are the lowest, at least on the chart that I was looking at. But
because
so, if you're just your typical American omnivore, let's say, you're not already a vegetarian or a vegan or something, if you switch one meal a week from beef to vegetarian, you will decrease your carbon footprint more than if you reduced your food miles to zero.
Whoa.
Right. So if you actually, the distance your food traveled for you to eat it was zero, meaning you're basically completely eliminating the carbon footprint of transporting food, as much as, you know, as you can, that still wouldn't have as much of an impact as just swapping out one hamburger for a salad. So if that's your interest and you're not already, you know, a vegetarian or a vegan, then that would do much more. And if you are a vegetarian or a vegan, the carbon footprint of your eating is already really low, you know, compared to the average. And there's just not that much there. There's not much gain to make from buying locally. But it gets worse than that because it may be actually a net negative to try to buy locally. Depending on, there's a lot more that goes into it. So for example, different locations the environment and the soil is better geared towards certain kinds of produce than others. So, for example, an acre of land in Idaho can produce about 50% more potatoes than an acre of land in Kansas. So if you live in Kansas, it's actually effective for you to buy Idaho potatoes rather than local potatoes. Your local potatoes cost more to produce in terms of carbon and inputs, et cetera, than shipping a potato from Idaho. In fact, it could get so extreme that one analysis showed that if you live in the UK, the beef you import from New Zealand has a lower carbon input than beef that grown right in the UK.
Why?
Because it's just so much more efficient. The herding and the grazing and whatever is so much more efficient in New Zealand that even when you include the cost of shipping it from New Zealand to the UK, it's still more efficient to just get UK beef, New Zealand beef than UK beef.
Oh boy.
So you have to know. And you know, the other thing is the system is kind of developed. I mean, there's a reason why Idaho grows a lot of potatoes, because they have conditions that are optimal for growing potatoes. Mm-hmm. So buy your damn potatoes from Idaho. Buying locally is actually a net negative because it's actually the inputs are greater just based upon optimization, matching the location and the environment to what you're growing. There's also economies of scale. A large industrial farm may just be more efficient than a local farm, and that may completely erase any advantage of buying locally. So unfortunately, it's complicated and there's no simple formula. You almost have to know for everything what the net cost is of buying from different sources.
You mean down to the individual farm, the individual product?
Yeah. 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 I mean, you can't make any broad statements like, oh, I bought this locally, therefore it's better. You can't say that. You just can't say it. You know, all you could say is that one variable. You're just looking at one variable, but it's often not the most significant variable in the carbon footprint and the environmental impact of what you're buying.
Is that true if you grow your own?
Well, yeah. I mean, growing your own is massively inefficient. I mean, I have a garden and I grow as many vegetables as I can on the area that I have for that. It costs me much more to grow my own vegetables than they're so freaking cheap in the supermarket. But I don't do it for that reason. I do it for the fun of having a garden. But all right. So here's the thing though. I'm going to add this. The carbon footprint is not the only consideration. Now, you know that I don't believe in the propaganda about organic farming. The evidence does not support this construct of organic farming. Although, I do think there are a lot of complicated issues surrounding sustainability of farming and all that sort of stuff, but I'm not getting into that. But in any case, what I do think the biggest advantage for the world of local farms and why it's probably a good idea to mix some local farmers market purchases, in there is that local farms generally have a much greater diversity of varieties than the large industrial farms. So by supporting your local farms, you are supporting a much greater biodiversity in our crops. Local farms can grow varieties that are like heirloom varieties that don't have to be optimized for shelf life and shipping. Mm-hmm. The food that travels a long distance, those varieties, and it's not genetic engine modification, it's just hybrids and cultivation over the last couple of centuries, they've been optimized for shelf appeal, shelf life, and the hardiness for transportation. Often, even at the sacrifice of taste and nutrition. In fact, there are genetic modification programs which are trying to figure out why that happened, because it was an unintended consequence. If you are prioritizing those variables, just by chance alone, other variables are going to suffer. You prioritize hardiness, taste is going to suffer because you're not prioritizing taste. And so inadvertently over the years, if you buy a tomato grown in California on a huge farm, the variety of tomato that you are buying is not going to be as tasty or as nutritious as a local heirloom variety that can't be shipped across the country, but you can buy at your local farmer's market, or that you can grow in your garden, which is the other advantage of having a garden. You can grow heirloom varieties that are not really commercially viable, but they're perfect for your backyard garden. So, but I know, you know, Kevin Folta and other scientists are working on figuring out which genes accidentally got screwed around, and to try to selectively put back those flavor and nutrition genes into the commercially viable varieties. So we'll actually, genetic modification will lead to more varieties and better varieties than breeding has, because the traditional cultivation has actually done, we've had to make some real sacrifices in order to get, you know, the commercial varieties, whereas genetic modification can undo that inadvertent damage, ironically, you know, despite all the propaganda against genetic modification.
Steve, you just want to grow the tastiest bananas you've ever eaten.
Absolutely.
In your basement.
And strawberries. I want to grow commercially viable strawberries that taste like those native strawberries that Kevin sent me that were awesome. But there are these tiny little things that you can't commercialize. So they sacrificed flavor for big red strawberries. But that flavors, those flavors were unbelievable. Those strawberries were so delicious. Imagine if you can have that big, juicy strawberry that had that incredible aromatic flavor of these other non-commercial varieties. That's what genetic modification could do. The bottom line is, I'm not arguing against local farms or against buying locally. You just got to put it, don't think that you're necessarily lowering your carbon footprint. You may not be. I think a mixture, you know, buying most of your food from the efficient large farms and some of your food locally when it's in season, depending on where you live, et cetera, is fine. That's great. Some people try to buy only locally. The other thing is, when you do that, you sacrifice variety, which is not good for your, is not good for your, you know, nutrition and your health. You want to have a good variety all year round. I can get strawberries in January. You know, yeah, the strawberries I get in June are much better, but I still like the strawberries I get in January, and their strawberries are loaded with nutrition. We are better nourished now because we can get vegetables from around the world. So I don't think we should go back, you know, to just local farms, just, you know, small local, losing the economy of scale, you know, farms that are not necessarily optimized, optimally matching the variety with the environment. We want the best of both worlds. Get the economy of scale and the advantages of growing our potatoes in Idaho, but mixing in some heirloom varieties grown locally. That's, I think, the best of both worlds. Well, guys, before we go on to science or fiction, we have a couple of announcements. First, we want to remind you that the Amazing Meeting 2015 is coming up in July in Las Vegas. The SGU is going to be there, and it's going to be amazing, like it is every year.
And this year, it's actually on the Strip. Right, we used to be at the South Point, and now they moved it to, what was the hotel again?
They are now at the Tropicana. The
that's right. It is the Tropicana.
Renovated Tropicana.
Yep, July 16th and 19th. The SGU will be giving a live show. We'll be having a dinner with our entertainment and our auction that we typically do. Always a ton of fun. The speaker lineup is amazing this year. It really is.
MC George Robb again this year leading the way. Dr. Berriches will be there. Dean Cameron, our friend, will be there. Timothy Caulfield, we interviewed him earlier this year. He will be there. Brian Deere, Steve. You're very familiar.
I want to interview him. Good work. I absolutely want to interview him.
Our old friend Ray Hyman will be there as well. Robert Kenner, director and producer of Merchants of Doubt, will be there. I mean, so many good guests.
Simon Singh, good friend of ours, Simon Singh.
We haven't seen him in a while. Simon Singh will be back again. And
Richard Saunders.
Richard. Just wouldn't be Tam without Richard, as far as I'm concerned. And is making his very first Tam appearance, Dr. Dean Adell. I call him the Carl Sagan of science-based medicine, because he was out there doing it right, doing it first before anybody else. Back in the late 70s and 80s and right up through this past decade, he's just an incredible, incredible advocate for science-based medicine.
Yeah, I can't wait to meet him in person.
And a cool guy.
So also, Steve, I wanted to bring up, you know, the OCH series is completed. It's fully launched up on the Skeptics Guide YouTube page. The backer awards are starting to flow. I promised that they would be going out when we finished posting the episodes, and indeed they are going out. And also, you know, there is so many people to thank. One of them is Joe Bellucci, who did a phenomenal amount of work for us, has been working with the SGU. You know, he's just become a dear friend of ours. I also wanted to thank Jeff Handy for doing an enormous amount of editing work. You know, he took over very early on in the process and helped us get the whole thing wrapped up very nicely, and I loved working with him. And I also wanted to thank Phil Hudson, who is, my film mentor, and who, you know, not only shot Ock, helped us finish the episodes, and, you know, just a all around awesome guy to work with.
I also want to mention that we asked a few months ago for people to send in applications for an internship position. And I want to let you all know that we have not forgotten you. We actually got over 100 applications. We are going through them, you know, slowly but surely. Our plan is to do our first round of, narrowing the list soon, and then do a second round of maybe interviews, and then hopefully make our decision by the summer so that the interns can start probably over the summer or towards the end of the summer, depending on their schedule. So if you've sent in an application for the SGU intern, we haven't forgotten you. We will be getting back to you soon. All right. Well, with that, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Although, Bob, you are taking over for this week.
Yes, I am. These news items come from the week of our first podcast in May 2005. So that's my angle on this one. It took me forever to go back in time to find these. I had to do it very slowly.
Scientists have invented a 1 gig thumb drive.
So let's get to it. So you ready, guys? Here's number one.
Yes, Bob.
So number one, after 30 years of dimming, the planet's surface is brightening. Number two, as the world warms, vegetation could double the frequency of extremely hot days experienced. And number three, our most creative thoughts come when we're walking. Steve, we will start with you.
All right. After 30 years of dimming, the planet's surface is brightening. I mean, I'm assuming that has to do with the amount of snow coverage. So that would imply that the amount of snow coverage was increasing. Now, we know that the long-term trend is that it's decreasing. But what is this referring to, a temporary uptick for 1 year or a reversal of the trend? I don't know. Temporary uptick, sure. Reversal of the trend, I don't think so. As the world warms, vegetation could double the frequency of extremely hot days experience. I think that could be true. More CO2 is more plants. They hold on to warmth. Okay. Our most creative thoughts come when we're walking. Yeah, sounds like a one-off psychological study. That sounds perfectly plausible. So, you know, the one I have the biggest problem with is the first one about the planet brightening. It depends on what they're really talking about, but I'll say that one's the fiction.
Okay, number one is for Steve. Evan.
Well, yeah, I thought of snow as well when we're talking about the planet's surface brightening. I mean, what else would brighten the surface? I suppose deforestation, which could lead to, you know, deserts and more grass plains and these sorts of things, could technically do that as well. There could also be more algae in the ocean. Perhaps that has a reflective nature to it, in which it affects the brightening. But again, after 30 years of dimming, the planet's surface is brightening. So in 2005, I'm not really sure that that's correct. I don't know if those time spans are necessarily line up with 2005. As the world warms, vegetation could double the frequency of extremely hot days. Double. Sounds like a little alarmism there, in a way. That's a lot, doubling the frequency of extremely hot days. But I guess that all depends on what you mean by extremely hot days. 90 degrees Fahrenheit or above, I suppose. Creative thoughts come when we're walking. Sure, maybe scientists have discovered that there's Obviously, people have a rhythm, their own rhythm when they walk, and that rhythm creates some sort of biofeedback to the brain that the brain uses to sort of get its own kind of beat going, and therefore it kind of chugs along like an engine, the pistons of an engine, maybe. Hard to go wrong here with Steve. I guess I'll have to go with Steve in the surface is brightening one. I'll say that one's fiction.
Okay, Jay.
You're saying after 30 years of the planet's surface dimming, it's now brightening?
Yes, that's what it says.
Why, first off, would it dim? And now the planet's surface is now brightening as if something dramatic has changed. I don't know. That one seems kind of strange to me. It's just very odd. I don't know. Okay, let me just move on to the next one. So as the world warms, vegetation could double the frequency of extremely hot days experienced. I mean, I can understand there's a relationship between the amount of vegetation and possibly the overall temperature of the planet. And also that vegetation could be in the ocean as well, which could have an effect somehow. I would say that that one is probably more true than the other ones. And then this one about our most creative thoughts come when we're walking. I could see that in a way, like, you know, when you have your blood flowing, I know your brain is always getting a top priority as far as oxygen goes, but it might perk you up a little bit, get the juices flowing, as they say. But at our most creative, I don't know. I mean, I'm skeptical of that we're at our absolute most creative, and it certainly doesn't work that way for me. My anecdote is more important to me than everything else. So I'm going to say that one is fiction.
So you all agree that number two, as the world warms, vegetation could double the frequency of extremely hot days experienced. You all think that that one is science, and that one is, it is science. This comes from a Purdue University climatologist, back in, the 2005. Essentially, he believed that, that global warming could change vegetation patterns in such a way, that the vegetation impacts the number of extremely hot days due to a significant degree above and beyond global warming itself. This guy, Diffenbaugh, he was an assistant professor of Earth and Atmospheric Science in Purdue's College of Science. He says that Earth's climate is all about relationships, and this study shows that ground cover plays a significant part in determining changes in climate extremes. He continues, "We are accustomed to hearing that greenhouse gases affect climate, but they are not the only factor we should consider. Our climate models also must incorporate the effect of vegetation if they are to capture the full scope of reality." It would be nice to know what he thinks now, 10 years later, but I don't know. So let's continue. Let's go to one. After 30 years of dimming, the planet's surface is brightening. Steve and Evan think that this one is fiction. Jay thinks it's science, and this one is science.
Ooh.
It is science. Yes.
Is it really?
Yeah. So this is based on a detailed study back in 2005, of the solar energy that reaches the land. From 1960 to 1990, there was actually a 4-6% decline of sunlight reaching the surface of the Earth. So when the scientists crunched the numbers to get the latest data, they wanted to see where they were at. They discovered that the trend had reversed itself in 2005. The planet's surface has brightened by 4% in the past decade. Steve, you were saying you're wondering if this was a brief spike, but this was data from a decade's worth of information, so that it had brightened by 4% mm-hmm. instead of going down 4-6 as it had, in 30 years, 60 to 90.
Why is that?
So possible causes, the number and composition of aerosols, which is the liquid and solid particles suspended in air, and also how the aerosols affect the character of clouds. Now keep in mind, I know Evan, you mentioned this, I was debating whether to bring this up, but 70% of the planet's surface is ocean, and there are no long-term surface brightening or dimming measurements on that. So this is just land area. I don't think that would have changed your answer much, but that's a significant thing. So that means, of course, Jay, way to go. Our most creative thoughts come when we're walking is fiction. The actual title was Creative Thinking, Try Lying Down. So this was research that was new in 2005. By ANU PhD graduates, that they suggested that to be our most creative thoughts, the best way to accomplish that would be to be lying down. And what he bases all on people solving anagrams more quickly when they were lying down compared to standing up, which is an interesting way to approach that problem. And I think that seems like a reasonable conclusion, although I don't know how extensive these tests were. He said solving an anagram often produces a aha or eureka moment. The answer appears suddenly, often out of the blue. These insight moments are similar to what people experience when achieving creative breakthroughs, Dr. Lipnicki said. So now the reason why this happens, they're not sure, but it may involve differences in brain chemistry between lying down and standing up. In theory, is another quote, in theory, there may be greater release of chemicals, noradrenaline, in the brain when standing up than when lying down. So, good job, everyone. Well, not everyone, just Jay. Good job, Jay. Nice try, everyone else.
Thank you, Bob. I got one right.
I was hoping for a clean sweep, but I'll take two.
All right, thanks, Bob. Evan, do you have a quote for us for this week?
Here's this week's quote. Selling eternal life is an unbeatable business, with no customers ever asking for their money back after the goods are not delivered. And that was by Victor Stenger, an American particle physicist, philosopher, author, and Nobel Prize recipient.
Yeah, he was awesome. Unfortunately, we lost him last August. If you recall, we talked about on the show that, Victor died in August of 2014. All right, guys. Thank you all for joining me this week.
Thanks,
brother. You're welcome, Steve.
Hey, good to be back.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.